Welcome to Cattlecast.
Welcome to the special Black History Month edition of Cattlecast. I am Lansing Township Supervisor DeAndre Hayes. 30 years ago, Marlon Riggs' documentary, Color Adjustment, a history of African-American portrayal on television, traced 40 years of race relations through the lens of primetime entertainment, scrutinizing television's racial myths and stereotypes. Joining me today is Dr. Julian Shambliss from Michigan State University. Dr. Shambliss and I will revisit some of these topics discussed in the documentary, as well as critique some modern day shows on their portrayals of African Americans. Hello, Dr. Shambliss.
Hello, thanks for having me today.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So what did you think about the documentary Color Adjustment?
Well, you know, I think this is one of the classic documentaries sort of exploring depictions of race. And for African Americans, the evolution in terms of their depiction that you see on display here is really crucial to understanding race relations in the United States. So the emphasis on a kind of persuasive whiteness and a kind of subject nature to Black people in a secondary role, that their Blackness is connected to a subservience, a lack of intelligence, a kind of almost physical, almost never mental. These are kind of recursive patterns in media. And it's only in the sort of modern era where you start to see more and more people of color and greater activism around trying to provide a more broad-based understanding of Black people and Black diaspora that you start to see that change. So when you're looking at Color Adjustment, what you're seeing is the roots of a kind of mediation around Blackness that really stretches back to the 18th century, right? And the minstrel imagery and some of the ways that, you know, whiteness perceives Blackness and then acts on that in terms of popular culture.
I think that's a great insight. And it made me think instantly when I was watching the documentary specifically of Julia. So I never had the opportunity to watch it because that wasn't quite my era. But the first time you see this intelligent Black woman who has a career, who's not subservient, however, she's carrying the stereotypical idea of a single Black woman. And so it's not a nuclear family. They were, I guess, kind enough, and I use that in quotation marks, to say that she did have a husband who died in the war. However, it just made me think, there's a famous Hollywood producer named Aaron Spelling who said, and it's quoted in a documentary, TV is the cotton candy for the eyes. So what do you think that image of the single Black woman, that being the first popular Black woman who has it together and lives in a nice neighborhood, but still has that title of single woman and single mom?
Right. You know, Julia is a really important example of both evolution and devolution. And I say that because you have to understand that when you look at the media landscape prior to that, any role sort of attributed to a Black woman is either sort of fitting into like a Jezebel sort of stereotype or a mammy stereotype. So these are secondary stereotypes that we can scratch, that stretch back again to the 19th century, but are probably popularized for many people in films like Gone with the Wind, where you have these sort of like women who are servants in a household, the maid, the nursemaid, or they're sexualized objects, like they're sources of temptation and sort of something that's to be possessed. So in Julia, what you're seeing is an attempt on a part of the mainstream media to introduce an acceptable Black female character. And if the fact that she's a widower is in fact a signal to the audience, this white audience, that she is actually okay, right? It's not a broken family. It's right. In fact, a family that falls within what in American context is a kind of acceptable framework, because there's even things that seem simple, like rich versus poor. In the American context, there's an acceptable kind of poor and there's an unacceptable kind of poor. Mm-hmm. And if you look at popular culture, there's white people in popular culture are often fit into the acceptable poor. Think about depictions of white people during the Great Depression, like the Waltons, which is a very famous example. Whereas unacceptable kind of poor is Black people, and they're often situated in a space that signals to the white audience that is problematic, the ghetto. So like Good Times and things like that. So when you see a character like Julia, what you're seeing is a kind of set of cultural signifiers to a primarily white audience that's designed to make this Black female character acceptable to people. So she's a widower, which means that she was in a decent Christian marriage. She lost her husband. He died in the war. So he was okay because he died for America. She's raising a kid and she's professional. Oh, you should like her. She's just like you, except Black. Right?
Yeah.
So it's a really complicated set of narratives built in that.
And that's very interesting, this whole idea of assimilation. And so you see Nat King Cole, who had this very successful show. He was non-threatening by all definitions of what an acceptable Negro would be at that time. However, they didn't have the sponsorship to continue his programming. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there's always a question about how these characters are able, like black performers are able to exist in the marketplace. And one of the things about a person like Nat King Cole is that his success really stresses the boundaries of what's acceptable for a black performer, or black narratives, right? So his positioning in the media landscape is one that supersedes what the advertisers believe are capable for black people. Because you got to remember, the advertisers have to believe that black people can consume at the same level as white people. And that's part of the calculation here. So when you say, well, he can't get sponsors, the sponsors are assuming that the black people don't have the money for it. And this is actually one of the things that's really important in terms of like the post-war narrative. Some of the most successful black businesses actually position themselves as saying, you know what, there is a black middle class. Think of Johnson Publication, right. Jet, Ebony. Like, they are delivering on the idea that there is a black consumer class. And in the case of television, they lag behind. And that's I think that's a prime example that you see when you look at something like Nat King Cole. This is the assumption on the part of the people who are the sponsors that these products are out of the bounds of African Americans. And there's definitely some question about income and access to the economic marketplace that we do have to talk about in terms of African Americans, but that's really what it comes down to.
In the documentary specifically, it's interesting how we talk about how television has made its way into various families, homes, you know. It started with a very small amount, and then as time progressed, it got to almost 90% of families were integrated in television. They were eating TV dinners around the television. You know, that was their source of entertainment. And so some of the earlier, introductions to Black people in film during that time was Amos and Andy. And Amos and Andy was very controversial for a myriad of reasons. But in the documentary, Amos and Andy was identified as a television show that perpetuated stereotypes and cliches about Black men. Could you explain the possible source of this distorted portrayal?
Sure. We can trace Amos and Andy, which to the radio program, which was white people pretending to be Black people, which goes back to the 19th century, really to the 18th century, to minstrel shows. Mm-hmm. It's important to recognize that the minstrel show was the basis for the Jim Crow persona, right? So this is a white performer dressing up in blackface and, you know, dancing around, singing. This is where the term jumping Jim Crow comes from. There's a number of theoretical constructs that we can associate with this. One that I think remains very, very potent is the idea that for the white audience that's watching this white person dressed up in blackface, they're projecting a set of thoughts around, at least prior to the end of slavery, projecting a set of thoughts around the freedom, the sort of childlike existence that they associate with Black people. That, you know, this is one of the tropes of slavery and the antebellum period. The reason that Black people were slaves, they were unable to govern themselves. They were basically giant adult children who would frolic and run around and not do anything unless they were like controlled. They needed control. That idea for a white working class was both one that drove racism but also animosity, right? So one of the things that white working class people who enjoyed the minstrel show were enjoying was that they were rejecting a kind of resentment that they associated with Black people not having to work like they have to work, which gets transformed into another kind of a narrative in contemporary landscape. After that idea is sort of like, you know, encoded into popular culture, the idea of the entertaining Black person, the singing and dancing Black person, that just persists through every evolution of popular culture and popular media. So you see it on the stage in the 18th century, 19th century. It gets incorporated into advertising. So a lot of minstrel songs become very popular to be sold to households. It goes into radio. So like you hear Amos and Andy, the radio program, that was a very big success, and it becomes a television show where the same sort of persona gets incorporated and replicated in the new media of television. So it really stretches right back to that sort of like late 18th, early 19th century sort of like idea.
So how would you describe the evolution of the Black TV family from Good Times that was on television in the 1970s to more recent shows like Black-ish?
You know, that's a really complicated question. I think one of the things that happens when in every decade since the 1970s is an attempt to normalize, I use air quotes when I say normalize, the Black family.
Yeah.
So in the 1970s with Good Times, that was an attempt on the part of a very, what I would honestly say is a very effective and courageous producer, Norman Lear, to tell the story of a working class Black family in the ghetto that humanized them. Now, it's important to think about context because at the time when people talked about Cabrini Green, like, you know, the sort of like the stereotypical public housing project in Chicago, they often described it in the context of a lawless, soulless, destructive space, that no good thing could come from there, right? Like, you know, that it needed to be destroyed or it needed to be policed at the very least and destroyed at the very best. And so to have a show like Good Times in that context where the people, it is a family, right? There's a father, there's a mother, There's striving young people who want to get out of the ghetto, right?
Yes,
there is no sense that these people are incapable of evolving or are striving for better. And remember, this is not necessarily that much of a shock. That same narrative could be attached to white people in every sort of like family drama where they're poor. Like, you know, there's a mother, there's a father, they want to make better.
Right. The American dream.
Right, it's the American dream. So it's really revolutionary because, like, oh, they're in the ghetto and they're not animals.
Ooh.
it's true.
Surprise, right?
Like, yeah. In the 1980s, you get a kind of Black family that's in the middle class, which, again, is a shock to white people.
Yes, it is.
Right? Like, oh, they're middle class white people. They're professionals. They went to college. Yeah, that happens, right?
Right.
Black people.
So it makes you think of the Cosby Show, you know, and for the first time, it may have been cool to have Black people integrated into neighborhoods that were due to redlining and other type of discriminatory policies kept us out of those type of neighborhoods when a realtor wouldn't even show you a property based on your skin color. So, to see the evolution of how we've gone from Good Times to Black-ish. So it's this idea of this Black family, a successful father, a mother who's a doctor, by all intents and purposes, they've achieved the American dream and they're worried about cultural. Have they lost their sense of idea and culture? Have they misstepped and wanted to provide a better life for their children and not expose them to the things that perhaps catapulted them to the level of success that they currently found? And I think it mirrors what I think a lot of Black professionals, these are real issues that they have to deal with, you know?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. One of the things about Black-ish that resonates with a Black audience is that it does provide an opportunity for Black people to talk about that sense of disassociation that they have once they reach a certain kind of social economic landscape and the nature of them having to, especially with their kids, make clear to them that, you know, there is a consequences to your blackness in the world that you have to like take into account. And that is definitely something that within the black community is an open debate. I mean, you know, I'm going to personalize this in the sense that, if you're listening to my voice right now, you might think, well, geez, he's gone to school a long time, but I'm going to just warn you, I've sounded this way my entire life, right? Like, this is not a consequence of like some sort of process. Like, I have sound this way my entire life. I'm not like, I don't code switch. Like,
this is authentic you.
Yeah, this is how I sound, right? It's jarring. I have, as every black professional, whether or not they're willing to admit it, had a thing where I talk to someone on the phone and then they meet me and they have that moment of processing that I'm black.
Surprise.
Which I can see on their face. Right? Like, I can see he didn't know I was black. Oh, okay. It's okay, dude. I'm still the same guy you talked to. I'm sorry. But, you know, as a consequence, right, I'm not free of the concerns that define the black experience, right? Because I sound, I don't necessarily sound like I'm a rap star. So, you know, the challenge here for people of color, and I think it's true for many minorities that are in a position where they assimilate, is that they know that they are still a part of that group. And especially in the context of like some of the social and economic consequences of being a part of that group, what do you say to your kids, right? Like, you know, Black right. has done some really meaningful episodes about around issues of color.
Yes.
Like the talk, right? Like every father has to talk to their kid about the police.
Yes, they do.
And this is something that white parents never wanna, you know, take into account. Like, you know, if you have a child, you don't necessarily have to talk to them about, you know, the police might kill you right. just cause, right? But every black right. person is gonna, you need to be mindful of the police, right?
And the people, how people perceive you. Even right. as a young boy, I can remember my sister calling me being very distraught because her young son at the tender age of 8, she's in Oklahoma. You know, they're walking in the parking lot going into the grocery store and a woman kind of grabs her purse, an 8-year-old black boy. So it's this conversation that you have to have as a black parent with your young black children, especially young black boys at such a tender age where they're not thinking that way, but the world sees them as a threat. So it is something that black parents have to deal with. This is the reality for right. us.
Yeah. Yeah. This is part of that. That mediation, right? The way that, you know, black men and women are positioned in popular discourse. And it you're right, it starts very early. And there's countless studies about the way that this impacts, you know, young black boys in school, young black girls in you know, young black girls get sexualized earlier than their white counterparts. Black boys are more dangerous. They get written up. They get disciplinary actions more. And of course, those things become cumulative in terms of their life experience and make for the need for cultural sensitivity or anti-Black, you know, or a consideration on how teachers are being taught to think about the nature of anti-Blackness in the mainstream society really important, right? Like you've consumed, if you're an adult, a lot of messages about race and culture before you know it, right? Like before you fully understand it. And so what do you do to unlearn that? Like what questions do you have to ask yourself? You know, the same way that, you know, as a male, heterosexual male, you have to like pause and go, yeah, what about patriarchy? What about heteronormality, right? Like, and is there a way that I'm just sort of like assuming the world through a lens of like my masculinity and my sexuality.
Yeah. So what's interesting is we talked about the jump. So we started with Amos and Andy up to Blackish, but one of the ways that Black people have catapulted from that narrative of being in the inner city is through education, right? Education is supposed to be the great equalizer. So in the documentary, we see how things have evolved from where we started to the Cosby Show. But let's go even a little further and talk about A Different World, which was a spinoff of the Cosby Show. It featured historically Black college and universities. And during the show's run from about 1987 to 1993, enrollment at those colleges grew by 24%, 44% better than all higher education. Do you think there are any other Black shows that have made a similar impact on Black culture?
That's a good question. You know, I do think that A Different World was a special kind of affirmation for HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. Other than like Spike Lee's School Days, I can't really think of like a media property that had such a centrality around the HBCU. I do think that was unique. That remains one of the things about that really distinguished as a spinoff. And another thing about A Different World, as a spinoff, it was quite successful. Often spinoff shows aren't necessarily successful from a popular TV show. But that spinoff was successful in part because it did take up some of the cultural milieu of a kind of Black cultural landscape and make it a central part of the story. And, you know, the legacy of the HBCU, especially in the context of African-American experience, is a potent one for a lot of the audience. And because, as you rightly point out, the mainstream, the sort of, you know, predominantly white institution, can be fraught with a lot of psychological, sociological trauma or tension for Black students, right? You have to find your place there, is the way that, you know, is often described. And so it is a kind of unique example of success of that.
So have things gotten better in regards to how African Americans are portrayed on television? Can you expound upon that? That pause.
Right. So here's the thing. This is a complicated question because the documentary is from a particular historical moment. Mm-hmm. And in that historical moment, there were three television networks. Cable was mm-hmm. just sort of coming on, right?
Right.
So when you look at that television, you're seeing a captured media audience. So whatever is on those networks is really important, right? So you have an audience that's just huge in part because you don't have a lot of choices, mm-hmm. right? Now, when you look at the media landscape, it's a really complicated landscape. So in that way, it is better because you have narrow casting, which is like a technical term. It just means that you can think about a much smaller audience being a success for a television program. So
right.
Think about something like the CW, mm-hmm. which is a broadcast network. What counts as success in terms of ratings on the CW would be failure on broadcast television of the period the documentary is talking about. Mm-hmm. So a hit show on the CW is a failing show from that period, right? Like it wouldn't even made it to the second episode. It's so tiny. But on CW is a huge hit. And the CW does in fact have like a kind of adherence to a kind of rainbow coalition kind of depiction of people of color, right? It builds on the legacy of the WB and UPN, which were described at the time by scholars as urban networks. So they were dependent on Black viewers because they were trying to grow broadcast networks. And so their first cadre of programming was directed towards African-American, Malcolm and Eddie. You know, think about some of these shows. These were very niche shows in the landscape of a broad broadcast audience. Today we have streaming services. So you have Netflix with Bridgerton, mm-hmm. right? Which if you look at the cast, that is a show that is showing Black people in a context that they would never be depicted in 50 years ago. Exactly. Right? Like, you know, a black queen, right? Like, you know, to Duchess, right? It just would not happen, right? And you go, wow, that Shonda Rhimes, once again, she sort of delivers on a soap opera. Yes, she knows how to do that. And Netflix and Amazon and Hulu, all these streaming shows are hyper aware of their ability to sort of attract a global audience. So they do things like provide, even there's actually some controversy because the Netflix viewer algorithm, the suggestion algorithm, if you are a person of color, you should look at it because the way it shows you a movie is because you're a person of color. You may not know this. Yeah, like there's been some controversy because like, if you're a person of color, it'll show you the advertisement for a film, they'll show secondary characters of color, even though the story's not really about them. There's been a couple of stories written about this because your viewing habits suggest that you like things with black people. They're suggesting something to you, and so they show you that there are black people in this, even if they are not the main characters. It's showing you that because it's an algorithm, right?
Okay, yeah.
Other things like that, like short run series that you might find on something like Hulu or something like that, they're able to produce those things because they are looking for audience, right? They're looking to drive audiences. When it comes to broadcast television, are there more positive depictions of people of color? Yeah. Are there more than there used to be? Yeah. Is it equal or on par? No. Right? Are there behind the scenes more people writing shows? You know, this is one of the things that really, I think, often signals a tremendous success versus sort of like, it's just okay. Are there writers of color? Are there directors of color? You know, if you're trying to tell these authentic stories, is the authenticity sort of integrated behind and in front of the screen? These are places where the NAACP, with his annual media report, remains very skeptical and calls our attention to the fact that, yeah, for every astounding success you might associate with someone like Shonda Rhimes, there are still black writers, black directors, actors that are struggling in terms of like being on network television. There was a story that came out recently about Heroes and the black actor that was on there who was killed off because his white female counterpart didn't like him. You know, like he talked about the sort of racism he faced every day on the set. So it's difficult to say that things have not improved, but it's also difficult to say that we're at the place that everyone, you know, sort of suggests they want us to be at. It's a work in progress is what I would say. And I also with, you know, often stress to people that consumers do matter in this context, right? So if you're a black consumer and you want to see more black content, you got to kind of find it when you see it and like let them know that I like that, right? And follow, you know, follow those actors, follow those producers, engage with that material, right? There are some very successful people who produce material for black people, like say a Tyler Perry, and that's a figure that's, you know, controversial and problematic in one way because some of the material he produces is highly stereotypical.
Right.
It's telling a very, very, very kind
tired
of
narrative.
Pro-social, you know, conservative narrative, but it's also successful in part because there's not enough. And so it's like, you know, a person in the desert, they're given water, they will drink it. Right. And, so like, if you're upset with Tyler Perry, you know, are you supporting black people who do stuff that's not Tyler Perry, right? Like, Perry is producing stuff, so black people are watching it. If you want to see more stuff, you got to produce it. And black people need to be looking for it, right? Like, black people need to be, you know, aggressive consumers of black content. So, like, looking towards black, you know, media spaces and be aware, because if they support it, then those people get more money and so they can make more stuff.
Yes. And it's interesting that you talk about this dynamic of Tyler Perry. And, you know, there's so many thoughts and opinions about his work. And what I often have heard is the tired narrative of the struggling Black woman, the Black woman who's in a domestic situation where she's the victim or she has to be the breadwinner. However, I do think the beauty of some of his work is that he has empowered Black actors and actresses that have been looked over by mainstream Hollywood. He's provided jobs and opportunities for those who otherwise would not have had it. And he's been very successful in what he's done. And it speaks more to what you're talking about, that diversity of thought and presentation, because as Black people, we're not a monolith. So, you know, our entertainment and our hobbies, they vary. And it's a myriad of things depending on who you are as a person. We're multifaceted. Us being Black is just one part of who we are. It's not a definition of, you know, all of our hopes and our dreams and our likes and our dislikes. So when I hear, you know, that comparison, it makes me think about the Shonda Rhimes, who, you know, at one time dominated network television with her successful shows, and also some of the newer comers like Issa Rae and Ava DuVernay. What do you think about those works and how we have progressed to sort of say, Hollywood, you won't hire us, so we'll take an initiative to hire our own people to tell our own stories, and the storylines that you created don't exactly articulate our narrative or our creativity. So we're going to create our own. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think when you look at like someone like Issa Rae, her success sort of coming from basically a YouTube channel and creating content that gets picked up, she's an outlier, but she does point to like tremendous creativity that you find by Black producers that make their way onto things like YouTube, right? Like I'm always really impressed by some of the stuff that I see people produce on a shoestring budget that's on YouTube. Like they're telling stories, they're telling, be it horror or romance or, you know, LGBTQ stories. And as a Black consumer, finding it is always the challenge, right? Like, you know, you have to, you know, are you reading Shadow and Ash, which is like this blog about Black media. But a lot of Americans don't, you know, a lot of Black Americans don't know that Shadow and Ash exists, right?
Exists.
So how do they know that, like, you know, they're providing all this information? Like, well, you know, but that's one way that you find it. That's one way I find out stuff. Like, oh, you know, it's in Shadow and Ash. Or The Root, or, you know, Very Smart Brother, or like all these other... You know, you got to have those. If you're a Black person, you kind of have to like do this extra homework to find stuff that's not stereotypical. And on the other side, as creatives, as people like Issa Rae and Ava DuVernay, as creative, they have to navigate the media landscape. Like, you know, making entertainment product is a business challenge as much as it's a creative challenge. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, when you point to someone like Issa Rae or Ava DuVernay, you're talking about someone who's navigated not just a creative challenge, but also a business challenge. Shonda Rhimes did not grow to success telling the story of a Black lady. Not exactly. You know,
right.
She started off on Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
Right. Like that is not the story of a Black lady. Right. Yes. Scandal is the story of a Black lady. But, you know, when you look at her career, I'm like, that lady made her way through this very soapy white kind of thing and succeeded, and then leveraged that into like, I'm going to tell this story and I'm going to tell this story. And now she's, you know, got a Netflix deal, which, you know, I think it's some of us like dying and going to heaven in entertainment now. I'm off broadcast TV. I got a Netflix deal. And that, you know, the skills to do that, to learn how to do that, is in itself a challenge.
Right.
That's why there is, you know, continues to be called for professionalization opportunity for people of color in Hollywood. Because the behind the scenes, like the business part of show business is really hard. It's similar to every business. Like even, you know, I teach at a school and when graduate students of color are coming in, I'm like, yeah, there is the things about you writing your thing, but you know, you gotta like navigate this thing that's not written down. So do this and do this. Like, yeah, you got to do all that, but you need to do this and do this, right? Like, right. Don't forget this. There is never going to be written down. Someone's going to have to tell you, like someone told me, so mm-hmm. do this and do this. Don't do that, right?
Right.
That is so complicated, but it's so true. And it's made more complicated when you're a person of color.
I'd agree. Right? It's like, those unspoken words that are sort of a rite of passage.
Right. And so, yeah. You know, how do you gauge success in a marketplace where the technology is changing, streaming? Like, we are, broadcast television isn't gonna die. Not exactly, but it ain't healthy. It ain't healthy, right? Like, almost everyone listening to this podcast has probably got at least one streaming service. They probably have probably three services. I used to have this theory that there's like, you know, there's a limit to the number of streaming service a person is willing to pay for. And then pandemic hit. And now I'm like, well, you know, God don't like throwing craps to that theory, right? Like, cause now people got way more streaming service than I, you know, fiscally thought they would be able to handle, because you stream music, you stream video.
Absolutely.
All these other things. I'm like, there's a limit to how much money I can spend on streaming. Like a normal person can spend on streaming. Then the pandemic happened. Then I'm like, well, you know, all bets are off, right?
Exactly.
Like, people are like streaming, you know, I'm paying for streaming services. I don't even like them, right? I just need to watch something, right? So when we get to the other side of this, knock on wood, there's going to be a resettling mm-hmm. associated with this. And the audience for the streaming platforms is not simply an American audience. It's a global audience.
Yes.
And content from the diaspora that weaves together Black narrative and Black experiences, you know, that has always been a concern for people of color, right? So like things that are said in the Caribbean, things that are coming from France, you know, there's going to be more content like that that's going to come into play, I think. So there are going to be new opportunities moving forward, but how they're going to play themselves out, I'm not even sure. I'm not sure if the next big hit is going to be someone who's going to do like a YouTube thing and then they're going to do a this and they're going to do that. Are they going to like create their own website, do a social media campaign and like, you know, sell something or this or that? Or are they going to, you know, who knows what they're going to be doing? Things are changing so fast. But I do think that the idea of like a global audience that is rooted in diaspora, that can tell stories that weave together like these multiple perspectives. I think that's something that's very important to media companies like a Netflix, like a mm-hmm. Amazon Prime, like other.
Right.
And it also puts a lot of pressure on broadcast people, right? So, you know, you see actors and performers, you know, advocating for inclusion waivers and things like this. So we'll have to see what the next few years brings. It could be a real impactful renaissance. You do have people like CBS promising to have X percentage of their broadcast line to be representative. And coming from CBS, which is notorious for not being super diverse, that was a big announcement. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen? It is a question mark.
It is. And I feel like we can't touch on the evolution of Shonda Rhimes and her success or Black-ish without talking about something that was very controversial not so long ago in Kenya Barris's new show, where he himself became an actor after stepping behind the scenes on Black-ish and Mixed-ish and Grown-ish, Black AF. So right. Just very quickly, can you give me your thoughts about that?
Yeah. I thought that was a really interesting choice. You know, when I first saw it, I wasn't sure if it was meant to be parody or, you know, like,
right?
It was really complicated. And I wasn't actually sure if it was a scripted show or.
It was confusing.
And I think that was a little too meta, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I thought I understood, after thinking about it, I understood what he was trying to do. as a creative, I think that that was an opportunity for him to sort of like engage around the question of having made a sort of reputation on a kind of black content to metally think about that, like the think about this fact that I'm at some level monetizing blackness in a very particular way. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of playing itself out in that show, because there the anxiety and the pressure of that is really clear. Yes. Where it's never clear in Blackish, right? It's never clear. I don't think for the audience it's clear how complicated it must have been to write and produce a show like Blackish in the context of like a corporate broadcast company, because not every episode of Blackish clearly was okay with people, right? They had That's to right. have dealt with like some real tension. I mean, Dave Chappelle talked about this in the context of the Chappelle Show when he walked away from the Chappelle Show. He has talked about it openly about they wanted him to do stuff that he didn't agree with. Right? Yeah, yes. He didn't agree with. Right? Mm-hmm. And you look at the Chappelle Show like, what could he possibly have not been comfortable with? They did
that
all
amount
manner
of money that they offered, right?
Right, yeah, right. I mean, he did all manner of things on the Chappelle Show, and I'm like, I would have not thought that the racial draft. I mean, that skit alone is classic. But if you're pitching that, you know, that was complicated, right? Yeah. Like, and he did a lot of things like that. So what could they have possibly said to him? He's like, I'm out. Then it must have been horrifying. If we were to hear it, we would turn white, right? Like, that's how bad it must have been, right?
If it didn't pass his litmus test.
Right, yeah. He's like, well, I can't do that. Right? Like, you know. So for him to make that show, you can sort of see the struggle of mediation and blackness. Like, you know, it was a bold choice. I mean, it was a bold choice. I do think it was a bold choice. He's never going to get credit for it though, because it didn't land the right way. Like, I would have done it as like a found footage kind of thing or something like that, where you weren't quite sure what was going on. It would have made more sense when you were watching it. I remember going like, I do not know how I feel about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that feeling never really went away.
There you go. I think a lot of people felt the same way, and that's the sentiment that they're holding on. You either loved it or you hated it.
Right.
But everyone had an opinion about it.
Right. So, yeah. Maybe 20 years from now it's going to be a classic, but right now I'm like, I don't think that's going to get another season, put it that way.
Well, finally, I have to ask you, what is your favorite African American television show and why?
Oh my God. Probably my favorite African American television show. No one's ever asked me that before.
You don't have to narrow it down to one. If you have a couple or even a movie you want to mention.
I really like comics, right? So, you know, uh-huh. My research on comics. So I really like Black Lightning. The CW show Black Lightning.
Okay.
I really do like Black Lightning. And I really like Mantis, which is this one season superhero show that was on Fox that nobody saw but was brilliant. So I like superhero thing. You know, I can't say Cosby Show because... that's just the truth. Like, that has been ruined for me.
Sorry.
Yeah. You know, and I'm like, there are a bunch of black shows I could mention. I mean, the Jeffersons when I was a kid.
Oh,
really
the Jeffersons.
Jeffersons.
Oh, it's
my
still
mom
a classic.
Liked the Jeffersons, right? Like, we would, you know, like that's still a show that you can watch today and be like, yeah, that's a good show.
It's still funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, yeah, the Jeffersons, those superhero shows, you know, I like really bad. Like, oh, is there other shows that I would,
I love the
Jeffersons. I like Luther.
Luther?
Luther, but that's not, you know, that's not an American show, but
hey, if that's your favorite, then it's your favorite. We'll go with Luther. Luther. Yeah,
you love it for a different reason, but I thought that was a really brilliant show. Okay. I have to think about this, actually. No one's ever asked me that before. Of course, the superhero thing is real, right? Like, I am a huge fan of superheroes, right? So,
yeah.
Black Lightning, if you've never watched it, you should definitely check it out.
Okay, I'll have to put that on my list. I'm late to the party, but I recently got into Queen Sugar, which I'm finding intriguing. Yeah.
So all the Tyler Perry shows, I've watched like enough to know what it's about, and then I stop. So it doesn't matter what it is. That's always the same. I don't hate Tyler Perry, but I understand what's going on. And so, like, you know, I'm a geeky person to begin with. So, like, these sort of soap operas about this and that, I'm like, I see what you did there. I saw it. So if it comes up in conversation, I can say I saw it. But
but it's not your jam.
It's not. Yeah.
Okay.
It's not. Not
I
once.
Respect that.
Not once. Not once. He's never done one thing I'm like, oh yeah, I would watch this beginning to end. And it's not because it's not good exactly. Mm-hmm. If you're a Tyler Perry fan, do not come for me, because I'm not gonna change my mind. But it's just such a it's so one tone to me, right?
Like, oh, gotcha.
I do admire him as a business person. And as I say, he is providing a kind of cultural product that Black people want. But I would love for like someone who's like geeky and does sci-fi to do it. Like Lovecraft Country. That's a great one, right? I think of that. That's a Black, Lovecraft Country. That's another, that's the show. I'm like, that person who's doing that, when they do another thing, I will watch that. I will stop whatever I'm doing and be like, I'm gonna check this out, right? Because like, that's the kind of stuff I like.
Well, thank you, Dr. Shambliss. Thank you for joining me for this very special episode.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can find a link to the documentary Color Adjustment, which is available through Canopy, in the episode description. Again, this is DeAndre Hayes, and thank you for listening to Cattlecast.
Don't miss another great interview. Subscribe to the Cattlecast podcast and share it with a friend.
Hey, it's Didi in the Morning with Didi's weekly download from Capital Area District Libraries. This week's title is This Thing Called Life, Prince's Odyssey, On and Off the Record by Neil Carlin. A music journalist and friend of the elusive musician offers insight into Prince's life. To download or stream this or other featured titles, visit cadl.org/Didi.
Stacks 92.1.
A little rusty on your algebra skills? Well, good news, because you can still help with your child's homeschooling. Connect with Capital Area District Library's free online service through tutor.com. With Capital Area District Libraries and online learning services like tutor.com, anyone in the Lansing area can get help in over 40 different subjects 7 days a week between 2 p.m. and 9 p.m. The tutors on tutor.com are rigorously selected and vetted to make sure your children are learning from some of the best tutors available. To learn more on how to get started, hop online and head over to cadl.org/tutor. That's cadl.org/tutor. Remember, you must be a member of Capital Area District Libraries to use this free service. Just go to cadl.org and click on About, then select Getting Your Card. It's that easy with Capital Area District Libraries and tutor.com.